This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Bill McKibben. Bill is the author of more than a dozen books, including The End of Nature, Earth, and Deep Economy. Among the first to warn of the dangers of global warming, he is the founder of 350.org. He is also the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College. Bill McKibben is here today to discuss direct actions to prevent climate change and to tell us about his most recent book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist, published in 2013. Welcome, Bill.
Hello there. Very good to be with you.
What led you to write your book, Oil and Honey? What is your purpose?
Well, I wanted to get across both the local and the global aspects of this big fight that we're in. It's really important that we understand that we need to take care of our local places and make them perfect or better anyway. And Vermont, where I live, is a good example of that. So I describe a lot about my time with this apiarist beekeeper, Kirk Webster, first chemical-free beekeeper in the country, one of the people best surviving these collapse of honeybee hives and things. But then I also talk about how that's not enough. You know, our farms in Vermont were overwhelmed by Hurricane Irene 2 years ago. Many of them washed away our beautiful small organic farms, and it's a reminder to me that we have to deal with the global too. So I tell the story of our long battle against things like the Keystone Pipeline.
What prompted you to go from being primarily a writer to also becoming an activist and the founder of 350.org?
I think what really prompted me was the understanding that reason alone was just not getting anything done. I mean, I wrote the first book about all this 25 years ago. And I think my thought, like many people's thoughts, was that, you know, policymakers and things would take one look at the news that scientists were bringing them and look at the news that economists were bringing them about what to do about this, put a price on carbon, that kind of thing, and that something would happen. But nothing did happen. For 20 years, we've had a bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing in Washington, and it's been extremely successful. So the time came at a certain point when even those of us who aren't sort of political by nature decided we needed to form a movement that could do something about this, and so we went to work. 350.org, which we started 5 years ago, has turned into the first big global grassroots climate movement, and it's been great fun to watch it develop.
How do you see the efforts of 350.org being different from traditional environmental groups?
Well, we're less an organization than a campaign, and we try to get things going that everybody can come and play in, and that's certainly what's happened with the Keystone campaign. We helped get it started, but now it encompasses the whole environmental movement from small local groups up to the big green groups and really beyond the environmental movement, the people working on human rights and social justice, and that's the kind of coalition it'll take, and so it's very beautiful to watch it spread.
What led you to focus on the Keystone Pipeline as a key campaign for 350.org?
First thing was the size of the carbon deposits up there in Canada. There's an awful lot of carbon, as Jim Hansen at NASA pointed out. If we burned all the oil up there that we could, it would be game over for the climate. And that was enough to get us going. That's why 1,200 and some people went to jail in the biggest civil disobedience action about anything in this country in 30 years. But since that time, it's also turned into a really iconic environmental fight, maybe the iconic environmental fight of our time. And that's why people will be rallying, you know, in 175 places around the country today to try and draw a line against this Keystone Pipeline.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what strategies have you used in fighting the pipeline?
Well, people went to jail. People engaged in all kinds of demonstrations and rallies and actions. We don't have money like the fossil fuel industry does, so we rely on other currencies, the currencies of movement, passion, spirit, creativity.
Where do efforts to prevent the Keystone Pipeline currently stand?
Well, the president will make a decision sometime in the years to come, and we don't really know what it's going to be. I mean, when we started, everybody said it was a done deal and that we were definitely going to lose and so on and so forth. I don't think anybody is certain of that anymore. And at any rate, you know, people's hard work has delayed it for 2 years so far. 900,000 barrels a day of oil is nothing to sneeze at.
What is your evaluation of Obama in regard to the Keystone Pipeline?
I think it becomes the test where we find out if he's serious or not. If he does the right thing, then he'll be the first world leader to have, well, to have blocked a project because its effect on the climate. That'll provide him with a legacy, and it'll provide the world with a potential way to reopen this stuck and stalled climate negotiations in Copenhagen. If he does the wrong thing, then I'm afraid we'll just have to conclude he's, as on other things, some too many other things, a big talk, small action guy. In this case, he can't blame Congress. He gets to make this call by himself, and man, I hope he will.
What is the next decision point for the pipeline?
There will be a report coming out from the State Department at some point, but in the end, the president will be the guy making the call.
Would you elaborate on the efforts you feel have been most effective in fighting the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, I think having people go to jail was effective because it did the thing that sometimes civil disobedience can do, which is to, you know, to underline the moral urgency of something and to bring it to people's attention. So I think that was probably necessary. And I think the kind of ongoing scale of the response has been the most important thing after that, that nobody's let up, that nobody's tried to bargain it away or anything. Just kept saying, this is a good, clear, easy call, please do it.
In your book, you speak of ultimately not being able to solve climate change one pipeline at a time. Would you explain?
Well, I mean, there's just too many of them. So we have to not just play defense, we have to play offense. And that's why we've done this, among other things, this big divestment campaign that's going on all over the country now. And that's an exciting thing. 15 big cities led by Mayor McGinn in Seattle have agreed to divest their fossil fuel holdings, and that's exciting. And now lots of colleges and universities, churches, denominations are all doing the same thing.
Would you go into detail about what led you to launch the fossil fuel divestment campaign? Why focus on that?
I wrote an article for Rolling Stone about 14 months ago now that turned into one of the most widely shared articles they've ever had, and the premise of the article was that it turns out, according to a report from financial analysts in the UK who looked at all the SEC filings and things, that the fossil fuel industry and the countries that operate like fossil fuel companies, think Venezuela, have in their reserves of coal and gas and oil 5 times as much carbon as the most conservative government or scientist on Earth thinks would be safe to burn. That is to say, their announced business plan will tank the planet. Hence, we need to go to work trying to keep them from carrying out their business plan. They're a rogue industry, and people need to recognize them as such. So, as with the case of South African apartheid a generation ago, we do our best to try and weaken them politically. We can't bankrupt Exxon, but we can politically bankrupt them. And one way is to make sure that the important institutions of our life, our local governments, our colleges and universities, our churches and synagogues, withdraw their consent, stop engaging with and investing in these guys. That'll be a key part of this fight. It clearly won't win it by itself, but it's one of many fronts.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org and author of the book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you elaborate on the kind of response you've gotten to the fossil fuel divestment campaign so far?
Sure. Along with those cities, 7 colleges, I think, have divested now, and the United Church of Christ, the sort of original Protestant denomination in this country that traces its roots back to the Pilgrims, they announced this summer that they would divest. The Unitarian Church of America is taking a year-long discernment process to figure out if they'll do likewise. The same sort of things are happening around the world. In places where they haven't yet divested, people are picking up the pace. Last spring at the Rhode Island School of Design, our foremost art college, took over the president's office and hung banners out the window that said, we may be art students, but we can still do the math. So, you know, this kind of spirit of resistance is spreading.
For the colleges that haven't divested, what reasons do they give for not wanting to?
That they're run by a bunch of Wall Street guys who, you know, think that they can make more money doing this, the investing in gas and oil. The trouble is that they can't. Even on this score, it's a good idea. Independent analysis by the AP has demonstrated that colleges with a $1 billion endowment that had divested from coal and gas and oil a decade ago would have made far more money, $119 million more dollars in the last decade, than if they'd stayed invested the way they are now.
If you look worldwide, in a number of cases, there are countries that actually function somewhat as oil companies that have large reserves of oil.
Those are important, too. I mean, I'm off to Norway in a little while to, for instance, work on Norwegian reserves. Norway was one of the biggest state-owned oil companies on Earth. So those are important, too. They don't tend to dominate our political life the way that the fossil fuel industry does, the big majors. I mean, these guys are the biggest donors and things in Washington. Chevron gave the largest campaign donation post-Citizens United. So, it's key that we go after these guys because it's their influence on our political life and on the structure of our energy systems that's so decisive.
What response are you getting from the oil companies themselves?
They say, a few things I've heard from them say, oh, well, fossil fuel is essential. It causes lots of good things to happen. We run hospitals and things on fossil fuel. All true, all beside the point. Fossil fuel has been a good thing for much of its career, but now that we know the danger it presents to the planet, now that we've watched the Arctic melt, now that we know the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago, now that we see the endless onslaught of extreme weather that comes when you raise the temperature, we know it's time to change, and we know we can change. There are plenty of alternatives available, and, you know, there were days this summer when Germany, which is the one country that's taken this seriously, produced half the power it used from solar panels within its borders.
Have you seen any political effect yet at the level of our representatives in terms of listening more to you than to the oil companies in terms of decision making?
I think on specific issues we're starting to get a little closer. This Keystone Pipeline's become a big fight. A year ago, there were 60-some Democrats in the House who were willing to vote with the oil industry. That number's down to about 15 now, and I think we'll see something similar at votes this week. You know, it's not like we're winning the political battle, but we're not losing it as badly, and so that's progress, I guess.
Would you say more about the approach that you're taking to the countries that have oil reserves?
Well, we'll do all that we can to educate people there about what's going on and persuade them to point their countries in different directions. I think it's probably harder to influence some of them than it is to influence the oil companies close to home in Washington. That's hard enough, but I think the chance of influencing, say, Saudi Arabia or someplace directly are pretty small. That's okay, because if we're able to win the fight in Washington and Beijing and things, then we can restructure energy markets such that demand will drop for gas and oil and coal from those places.
Which experiences from your activist efforts have most influenced your thinking about the best approach to taking in addressing climate change?
I don't know. I think really the basic understanding is we need to build a big movement, big sprawling movement without leaders, but highly interconnected. You know, so the people in the Northwest who are working on coal ports and trying to stop the flow of coal, so the people there in Bellingham or Longview or Seattle aren't just relying on their own resources, but so that people all over the country and the world can pitch in some and help, and they can help on the Keystone Pipeline and, you know, on and on and on. We have to win a lot of these fights, and so it requires a big movement that works on local things but also cooperates on national and global things.
Are there mistakes you've made in your activist efforts that have been useful in informing your future actions?
Oh, I'm sure we make mistakes all the time, and we learn as we go along. We're a pretty young outfit. You know, when we started 350.org, it was myself and seven undergraduates in college, and they're in their later 20s now, and they're terrific activists. They've gotten better and better and better. So, you know, we just try to keep moving along, and we try to be so sprawling and redundant and with so many different things going on in so many different places I guess that if we screw up one, it doesn't make that much difference.
In your book, you mentioned the incident of the ice sculpture. Would you like to speak about that?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. This day we were going to do this, it was really wicked hot in D.C., the summer before last, I guess, and all-time record heat. And so we're going to melt this big ice sculpture in front of Senator Imhoff's office from Oklahoma. It was pretty good stunt. You know, he'd been building igloos in the snowstorm the year before, and so we wanted to make it clear that he didn't know whereof he spoke. But the same week, huge climate-caused storms had wiped out power across West Virginia. So everybody from West Virginia was calling us and saying, you know what, this doesn't look so good. We want that ice. It'd be a shame to see it melt. And so we called it off, decided that was a good idea, called it off. You know, it's good to be able to be in contact with people and listen to them all the time.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org and author of the book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Would you elaborate on how global and local climate movement efforts work together?
Sure. So, you know that people, say, in the Pacific Northwest are fighting hard on these coal ports and things, right? And so a lot of the fight's necessarily around, like, local issues, yes, like coal dust in Bellingham or things like that. But it's also important for there to be a big component about it that's about climate change, too. And in fact, I think that the governors of Washington and Oregon have now sent a letter to Washington asking Washington to help evaluate these projects not just on their local ecological impacts, but on their global climate impacts, and that's important. And for the movement, it means that we can, you know, send attention that direction, which is important. When things are hot and heavy there, we can make sure everybody in the country knows about it, just like everybody in the country knows about the Keystone Pipeline now and helps out on it.
Would you comment more on the coal and oil export issue in the Northwest and its importance relative to the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, it's important for the same reason. There's a huge pool of carbon in the Powder River Basin there in Montana and Wyoming. But Montana and Wyoming, like Alberta, are kind of landlocked and, you know, not well situated to get stuff out. So they have to run it to an ocean someplace. And, you know, your ocean there along the Washington-Oregon coast is the likeliest option. And well, they wanted a year ago to build 6 big coal export facilities. And I think 3 of them by now have been successfully blocked. But there's still 3 in the planning phase, and we're doing everything we can to keep them from getting built, to kind of stick a cork in the bottle out there.
Would you now tell us about the National Day of Action and Draw the Line events taking place the day this program airs on Saturday, September 21st? What is the goal of the National Day of Action?
The goal is to draw more attention to the Keystone Pipeline and ask the president to really draw a line there. We started using that language some weeks ago, but it became more appropriate as the Syrian crisis unfolded. Here's a line that we can draw, a red line we can keep from crossing, and we don't need a missile or anything to do it. We just need the president to stand up and say we're not going to build this thing.
Where are the Draw the Line events going to be taking place?
They'll be taking place all over the place. And if you go to 350.org, you can get a full list. I think, as last I heard, they were in 175 cities in 45 states, but doubtless it's more than that by now.
Could you give some examples of the types of events that will be taking place?
In New York, they'll be drawing a line, I think, where the floodwaters of Hurricane Sandy, where they washed up in each of the boroughs, you know, to remind people what's at stake. And I know in Seattle that they're telling people to bring red fabric with them to the gathering to make, I think, a red line. And I don't know quite where it's going to go, but I'm eager to find out because I'll be in Seattle for that event.
I believe there was also an event in Nebraska.
Yes, they built a barn, solar-powered barn, along the route of the pipeline, right on top of it, that they'll have to dismantle if they want to put this dirty energy pipeline in. They'll have to take down that clean energy barn. So that was a beautiful, beautiful project.
What types of efforts do you have planned over the next year for 350.org?
this divestment campaign is huge and growing. I'm headed off to Europe soon to help spread it there. It was just in Australia and New Zealand. So we're pushing it out there as fast as we can, trying to take on the fossil fuel industry everywhere.
And do you have thoughts of where to go after that?
No, not really. I'm a poor planner. Sometimes we tend to react too much, and that's probably one of my flaws and faults.
Would you say a bit more about the relation between oil and honey? That is the title of your book, and of course it does have to do with the local and the global, but I'd like to hear more.
What would you like to know more about?
Perhaps some of your experiences on the farm in Vermont and
sure.
how that helped inspire you, keep you going through it all.
Sure. This is a very beautiful farm, apiary, and in a very beautiful place. The Champlain Valley is a kind of bucolic piece of the Midwest that somehow got stuck in Vermont, the biggest agricultural valley in New England, and a very sweet place. And, of course, you know, the bees are a good way to get to know it because they roam far and wide, mile upon mile, and they bring back, as it were, a kind of report about how things are going out in those fields. You know that the report that they bring back now in much of the country is pretty grim. Bee colonies are dying left and right. The Times ran an article earlier this year saying they thought half the bee colonies in America might have perished last year. We think that this has something to do with a new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids that are causing problems, but it also has to do with climate change, with invasive mites of various kinds. It's hard for bees, but Kirk Webster's done a very good job of building this chemical-free apiary, and it's great fun to work in it and just be reminded what charming and interesting creatures these are despite their sting. You know, there they are working very cooperatively to produce massive amounts of honey, one grain of pollen at a time. It's kind of a miracle, really, if you think about it.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that we need you very much to help. If it doesn't do much good to listen or think about climate change, we need you to act on more than the level of buying the right car or putting in the right light bulb. This is a structural problem, and so its solutions will be structural. That requires political change. If we can weaken the fossil fuel industry some, maybe we can get that. That's what we try to do at 350.org anyway, so I hope you'll join in. And I hope you'll join some of those great Northwest groups in their efforts to block those rail lines, Climate Solutions and Sightline, and so many other amazing groups out there doing the right thing.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bill.
Thank you. What a pleasure to talk to you. What a nice, thoughtful, and gentle conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Take care.
You were just listening to Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, and author of the book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist, published in 2013 by Times Books. For more information, check on the web at 350.org and BillMcKibben.com. Again, that's BillMcKibben.com and 350.org. Bill McKibben will be the keynote speaker at Seattle's Day of Action Draw the Line event, which takes place the day this program airs, Saturday, September 21st, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Myrtle Edwards Park. He will also speak about his book, Oil and Honey, at Town Hall Seattle on Monday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.